Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to learn about vitamin C helping to prevent cell damage caused by toxins in the water. Well, when you consider how toxic our water is, and especially when people are swimming in public pools, that's really toxic because the latest study shows that, well, it's just filled with human feces. And that goes in your mouth, and then you end up getting all forms of diseases. But what about what comes out of our tap? Yes, this is from Nazarene University. There's a lot more on health and nutrition coming at you. Also today, I'm going to do my own analysis and commentary on just one of the candidates. I'm only taking one at a time and showing you why you should do your homework before you believe that someone is presidential or has the answers or is the right kind of leader based upon these debates. Keep in mind, none of these debates are spontaneous. The answers have been well rehearsed. They actually have focus groups that where they pretend to be in a debate and they have different questions thrown at them. And they have a whole panel of experts who then tell them what the answer should be. These are all so fake, they're all so staged that we really don't know who the person is. And the only way to really know what is the likely forward movement of a person is based upon what they've done up to that point in their life. So today I'm going to show you the truth about Kamala Harris. She's not what she pretends to be. But I'm not telling you that from my perspective. Rather, I'm going to tell you that from a perspective of Laura Bezalel. She is the law professor and former director of the Loyola Law School Project for the Innocent in Los Angeles. And this is reported in the New York Times. So, that'll be interesting. But I also have my own commentary on top of that. Then we're going to take a look at the overspend American, why we want what we do not need. And a little humorous piece for those of a certain age from Jeff Allen, The America I Grew Up In. That's our program today. And you will be able to hear me tomorrow at noon over all of our stations, and hopefully you'll tune in. First, we begin with a study that it's based upon the heavy metals that we frequently get in water, like, well, we get mercury and lead, lots of hexavalent chromium. These are all industrial application chemicals, and they're part of the chemicals employed in carbon and stainless steel welding and iron and steel foundries and cement and all of the textiles and dyeing. And we get trace amounts of these coming through and they get in our body. The trouble is it's very dangerous. For example, just one of these, hexavalent chromium, is an occupational carcinogen. That's according to the National Institutes of Occupational Safety and Health. Even short-term exposure can harm our eyes, our skin, and respiratory systems. So what do we do? Well, one thing that no one thought about until this study was vitamin C. According to the study, vitamin C may be the most well-known antioxidant, and they're looking at green tea as also being extremely important as well. And they're saying that vitamin C can make a big difference, and I would agree with that. So vitamin C helps your body to prevent cell damage caused by toxins. So that's why you should have vitamin C throughout the day. A study from Oregon Health and Science University shows that even a short exercise period enhances your brain function. That's correct. Now, this audience is probably one radio audience in America that exercises I'm going to imagine more than the average because we emphasize that. In fact, just as a little side, when I was first on commercial radio, WMCA, back in the early, mid-1970s, I was asked by a reporter, was I the new Carlton Fredericks? Mind you, I'm a young kid. I'm in my early 20s. I'm naive about a lot of things. I'm not formally educated in nutrition at that point. I would be. My original college background was in economics and business administration and accounting, cost accounting. So I didn't know what he really meant. But he said, well, you know, Carlton Fredericks is the most popular person in health in America, along with Adele Davis. Those two kind of reign for the last 20 years. So I began to listen to Carlton Fredericks' program, and then I went to one of his lectures, and I was amazed there wasn't a young person in the audience. In fact, every single person in there was gray-headed. And I'm just listening, and I'm watching. He's up on stage lecturing, smoking. And he appeared on television. I remember I saw him, I think it was on Merv Griffin, smoking. And he thought nothing of that. He wasn't into exercise, nor was his audience. His audience did not look healthy. His idea was high protein, eat a lot of meat, and it'll help you with hypoglycemia. And that was the big deal at that time, hypoglycemia. But I didn't see anyone that looked really healthy. And I remember at one of these lectures, I had an opportunity to speak with the audience, and they didn't know who I was. And I was just asking them, what do you think about exercise? What do you think about a veganism? They thought that was just stupid. And one of the persons kind of summed it up for all the other people. They said, well, when you're young, exercise is good for you, but it's not good for you the older you get. Actually, it's harmful. I said, well, who told you that? Well, everyone knows that. And that really galvanized my attention. So on my radio show, I was emphasizing exercise. In fact, I started back in 1975 on July 4th on Coney Island on this boardwalk, the first Natural Living Running and Walking Club meeting. And 5,000 plus people showed up. How do I know? Because I had 5,000 t-shirts printed and gave them as gifts to people. And one of those people who showed up was a gentleman named Sid Howard. Sid may be listening now. He owns his own delivery company. And he is quite simply, and not to argue about it, he is one of the two fastest milers in the world and has been, even in the 2 miles, for the last 40 years. And there were other people, Thelma Wilson, and who began their long journey of getting healthy. And I had a cover dish dinner. Now, some of you may have come to those cover dish dinners. They were wonderful. They were a lot of fun. Just simple things. We would make a dish, bring it to a place, or come to a place where they would have a wonderful, healthy menu, because I would lay out the menu, and a restaurant like Hisei's would prepare it. We did it once out on Long Island, because someone says, you keep doing it in the city, Gary. Do one out in Long Island. So I did one out Long Island, Huntington, and I got a call at 5 o'clock saying, we need a bigger restaurant. I said, well, how many seats do you have? Well, we can seat about 60. Okay. Well, we have about 1,000 people here, and it's growing. So they got the whole parking lot of the plaza, and everything was packed. And interesting, because that was the night that People Magazine were doing a feature on me. Nice feature. And they got some shots of all that. But the one thing that was common with all of the get-togethers, the cover dish dinners, of which there were dozens and dozens, and the picnics and the cooking classes, it was almost all young people. People in their 20s, teens, and 30s. There'd be a sprinkling of older people, but not that many. And the dances, wow. 1980, we had 5,000 people at the Red Parrot. We've done over 55 of those. I intend to do another one when I get back to the city. In any case, so what we had is we had one group of people who were very interested in a holistic lifestyle. exercise, stress management, eating really healthy, juicing, cleansing. And the energy of the people was completely different. They didn't come together to ask questions about, you know, their diseases. They came together to talk about celebrating life and all the things that were possible. And I then thought about the difference between Carlton Frederick's audience or what had been the health audience in America at that time. And it was very limited, extremely limited. And all the heads of it, all of them, Betty Lee Morales and Bob Hoffman, Linda, let's see, there was Gaylord Houser. These were nice people, had nothing against them on a personal level, but boy, nothing progressive in that. So today, when we're looking at exercise, if you're over 50, understand something. You need to do more exercise than when you were younger. In fact, the one thing you must do every day is exercise. And not what they're doing. What they're doing, they're always doing this. And they're always wrong about everything they do. Oh, you don't want to overdo it. Maybe 20 minutes a week. No, 40 minutes a day. You know, you have been treated as if you're incapable of doing more, and as a result, you stop at a comfort level, and then you end up with junk exercises, which means you're not going to benefit. You're not going to get rid of the fat. You're not going to lay down more muscle tissue. You're not going to stimulate human growth hormone. You're not going to stimulate endorphins, the feel-good hormones, all of which come when you do more vigorous exercise and longer. So here we have Oregon Health and Science University telling us that the neuroscientists at the university up in Portland found that short bursts of exercise within a longer exercise boost the function of a gene that increases connections between neurons in the hippocampus. That's the region of the brain associated with learning and memory. And by the way, this was published in eLife, major journal. So exercise is inexpensive, doesn't cost you anything, except for some shoes and, you know, running outfit. You don't need all those gadgets. You don't need the pulse. You shouldn't have those. And by the way, yesterday I was helping someone who was looking at a property, and going over in the car, I happened to turn on my meter. I carry with me an electromagnetic frequency meter, so no matter where I'm at, I can tell whether or not there are dangerous or safe levels of electromagnetic frequency. And it had been sent down because we just finished our new office, and we went through, and the office is completely zero electromagnetic frequency pollution. But in the car, it was reading very dangerously high. And then you start to realize that all those wonderful gadgets, oh, we can tell where you're at and play this song and the satellite's beaming. After all, how would you imagine the satellite would know turn left in 100 feet? It's got a beam on you, and that beam is electromagnetic frequency beam, and they are dangerous. So there's no reason you can't have your car re-outfitted by having all that taken out. You certainly don't want people tracking you, so have the tracking devices taken out. If you do that, then you've got a car that's not dangerous. But then even going into a house can be dangerous if you don't know where the electromagnetic pulses are coming from. You know, it's something, it's not that expensive, and it's something you should measure in your office and in your home. In any case, just understand you got to exercise all the time. Also, according to Brigham and Women's Hospital, an article published in the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry, they connect low social engagement, meaning being alone, to amyloid levels and cognitive decline. And this is interesting because early on, when I was just getting into the field, I was gifted by being able to meet some remarkable human beings. And here I am in my early 20s, and here they are in their 70s and 80s. But these were some of the smartest people, most accomplished in their fields in the world. And the reason I got to know them was because someone who I had helped with their health wanted me to help these people who were at the end of their lives and in careers. And I found them to be extraordinarily nice people. but they had made every mistake with their health possible. And what I found was a lot of them were living just alone. And one person in particular had some interesting things to share with me about that. And her name was Sarah Dona. She had been a great radical feminist socialist during the 19-teens and 20s and 30s and 40s. She was an author. She was one of the first line feminists, not the second, first. And those are the ones who had the most difficult time, who were helping to get the women's right to vote and helping to challenge other social issues. And I went over one night, and she lived at the Bancroft Hotel on West 72nd Street. And she had a nice apartment. And she was sitting there, and I was going to go over what I believe she could do to help herself with her conditions. And she looked at me, and she kind of turned her head in a strange way, and I said, "What?" And she said, "Well, I'm just thinking when I was your age, what I was doing and where I was at and how fearless we all were, how committed we were to justice and issues." And I said, "Well, from what I read, you still are today." She said, "Yes," she said, "but over the last 10 years, I've lost almost all the people that I were friends with, and they're gone, and soon I'll be gone." And so it's an interesting reflection when I see someone who is so naive and innocent about life and willing to help everyone. "And I'm thinking of myself," she said. And okay, so then she stopped and we went on and talked about how to help her live a longer life. But then on my way home, I couldn't get it out of my mind that here was a person at the very end of her life looking back towards what had been near the beginning of her life as an adult. And how often do we take life for granted and time for granted? Place and people for granted, friends and family for granted, opportunities and careers for granted, until one day they're gone. And then we go through this painful sense of loss and detachment. And isn't it time that everyone over the age of 40 realize that you are, like it or not, you're in your last stage of life, you're in your death cycle? Up to 40, actually the new biology says 27. Now that shows you how hard we're living, how many mistakes we're making, how overindulgent we are in things that speed up the aging process, speed up the telomeres dividing. And a lot of that has to do with spending time in isolation on social media, living your life looking down at an iPad. And instead of engaging in the social relationships that historically were so vital to a community. And I asked her that evening, Sarah Dona, I said, "What do you remember from when you were in high school?" He says, "Oh," she said, "I love the idea that we would do projects together. It was the together part that I really enjoyed. Projects come and go, but the people and your interactions with them can be indelible." And again, that stuck with me. Here was someone, I believe she was 81, remembering back to when she was a teenager and all that social activity with people, where there was just pure joy and excitement, the love of being around people. Today we don't have that. And I don't believe it's any form of social or intentional engineering. I just believe it is the unintended consequence to overuse and reliance upon technology and the disconnect from the importance of eye-to-eye personal contact and getting out of our hubris, getting out of our men and women caves, going into places, you know, going to social events, meeting with people that we can enjoy harmonizing that energy. So that's the importance of social relationships. They are absolutely essential to aging well. And according to this study, there's an association between lack of social engagement and increased risk of dementia. And so we should take it very seriously that social engagement and cognitive function are related to one another, and they decline together. So let's reverse that decline, and let's create a system of living where there's resilience and less vulnerability to circumstances beyond our control as we age. And by the way, if any of you had the opportunity to listen in on the webinar I did 2 weeks ago on Sunday, for nearly 4 hours, I went into this in great depth, and I believe that we now have the science to understand we shouldn't be alone. We need people in our lives, and nice people in our lives, fun people in our lives, not people who are just there to talk about their and complain about their conditions. Just a thought. Also, from Deutsche Center for Diabetes Research in Germany, an article published in the peer journal Metabolism shows that you can prevent diabetes with intermittent fasting. Now, I've mentioned many times that fasting or caloric reduction is one absolutely provable way to lengthen your lifespan substantially. So spreading out how you eat so you don't eat everything all at once, what I call grazing, where you can take an item of food, maybe just something simple, have some radicchio and leaves, which is Italian lettuce, red and white, and put some, make your own hummus, is very easy, with chickpeas and garlic and lemon juice and Himalayan sea salt and pepper and chives. And then you put, let's say, 3 tablespoons of that in the middle of radicchio, and then wrap the radicchio and have that. It's delicious. It's just a grazing snack, but it's got fiber, nutrients, protein, and so it will raise your blood sugar level just enough to make it stable so you don't drop down into hypoglycemia, which then triggers glucagon. So if you go too low in your blood sugar, your body says, hold on, you need some blood sugar. Or if you go too high, hyperglycemia, insulin's secreted to bring it back down again. So you're not on this this roller coaster. But grazing helps prevent that, and it's great for diabetes and prediabetes, and it's great to maintain our better metabolism and lengthen our life. So try that instead of sitting down to these big meals. Also, it was shown that antibiotics weaken our defenses against the flu, especially in the lung. This is from Francis Crick Institute, published in Cell Reports. Antibiotics can leave the lung vulnerable to flu viruses and leading to significantly worse infections and symptoms. And that is not known by most people, including most physicians. Remember, bacteria can be killed by one of nature's most powerful antibacterial agents, and that is antibiotics. Now, there are natural antibiotics like bee propolis and olive leaf extract and wild oregano oil, and these can really do a lot, and they're natural, and colloidal silver, for example. But most people don't do those. Most people use your traditional antibiotics, and these wipe out the good bacteria and literally destroy the gut biome. But what if you have the flu and cold, which are principally viruses instead of bacteria? Well, antibiotics are not going to work on viruses at all. So we're giving millions of people worthless and even dangerous antibiotics when they should be looking at what impacts the bacteria. So remember, you could end up having an infection. You take antibiotics and now the infection, which is viral, becomes worse in the lungs. Also, from the University of California at San Diego, an article published in the International Journal of Hygiene and Environmental Health, pesticide exposure is linked to teen depression in agricultural communities. That's correct. adolescents exposed to elevated levels of pesticides are at an increased risk of depression. One more reason why organic and pesticide-free is better. And from Chinese University in Hong Kong, published in the Chinese University of Hong Kong's publication and Chinese Medicine, a formula made using TCM herbs exhibits anti-cancer effects against metastatic breast cancer. And we know the incidence of mortality of cancer metastasis is very high. And so this is a very good herbal. It's four Chinese herbs, and I put them up on, one is called Green Create, C-R-E-A-T. Another is Siberian ginseng. Another is tea tree. And these are, you know, these are very, very powerful and natural. And they can help with this. How about that? Also, if from John Hopkins University, published in Hypertension, if your baby, your infant, is not getting enough vitamin D, they're at risk of high blood pressure later in life. So make sure that's the case. And finally, from Lanonsva, Moscow State University in Russia, swimming pools can turn your sunscreen into a carcinogenic toxin. So a lot of people smother themselves in sunscreen before getting into a swimming pool. You're actually doing something detrimental to your health. And they found that the combination of the ultraviolet rays of the sun and the chlorinated water cause ingredients in sunscreens to break down and produce toxic chemicals. And these chemicals have been associated with causing immune system damage and even cancer. So, wouldn't do that. And Brigham and Women's Hospital also found from a study that type 1 and type 2 diabetes affects the health of the inner lining of the blood vessels, and people with diabetes often experience complications of the eyes and the heart and other organs because of worsening blood vessel damage over the long term. So, what to do? Go on a healthy plant-based diet and make sure that you're taking pomegranate. Eat pomegranate. Drink the pomegranate concentrate, but that will help with the lining. We are 27 minutes into our program. I've just finished Health and Nutrition, and now we're going to take a break and come right back. And let's, before we go to some of these hard-hitting issues, let's hear from one or two of the people who've called in on our voicemail line, which is 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805. Oh, and before I forget it, I've had so many people calling since I've been out on the road, but I'm going to do a little sneak preview at an event that someone at the station is supposed to tell me we can announce. It's a big event coming up, but I'm waiting because I don't even know the phone number that you're supposed to call in. But it'll be a screening of a great, really important documentary, plus an interesting conversation with Leonard Lope on some challenging questions. And there's going to be a sneak preview of this film for almost 8 years I've been working on, the most comprehensive film ever done about the environment and global warming and our planet and the likely outcome of what we're doing. So all that's coming at you. And now we're going to take a break and be right back.
Hi, Gary. This is Bob from Long Island. I'm a long-time listener. I've often heard you mention about the dangers of drinking coffee, which I understand. However, I would like to know, are coffee enemas something that is healthy, or does the same apply to coffee enemas as it does to drinking coffee? In other words, are coffee enemas beneficial and healthy? Thank you.
According to Charlotte Gerson Strauss, who just passed, she was in her 90s, I think maybe 92, and she was the best advocate in the world for her father, Max Gerson's anti-cancer therapies, for the better part of the last 50 years. I visited her clinic in Mexico many occasions, and she was a big believer in enemas, coffee enemas. And there is a chemistry of what happens when caffeine goes into the system and through the portal vein and hits the liver and the release of toxicants out of the liver. You could go back to the court of Louis XIV and Louis XV, even Louis XVI, and you will see that enemas were very common. Interesting, because they believed that you had to do things like bloodletting, and so most people are not aware of this, but those who could afford it would have their blood let about every 2 weeks to supposedly purge the body of these toxic elements. They didn't drink water because they didn't trust water, because they believed water was the carrier of all disease, and they didn't want to mix the water with the humors of the body. In any case, they did what was called dry bathing, where they would just wipe themselves down in the morning with a piece of linen. And since nobody wore underwear, nobody wore underwear at all. Not the king, queen, the court, peasants. Instead, you wore a shirt, a white shirt. And you could change that throughout the day, and that could be washed. Clothes were never washed, by the way. Gowns were never washed. I'll get into life at court and explain the differences on an upcoming show. But they were very much into health, but you wouldn't know it from some of their unhealthy habits. But they believed in enemas, and they would put all forms of things in these enemas to cleanse themselves. And enemas went through a period where no one wanted to use them until probably the Gerson diet started it. She was the biggest advocate running around the country talking about the health of the enemas. I do not believe that the enemas should be overused if a person wanted to do an enema, because they are having trouble with constipation and regularity. Because just like a laxative that helps move the bowels and moves the congestion of the fecal matter, which is made up of dead cells and lignocellulosis and fibers and also bacteria, huge amount of bacteria. When you're stressed or not hydrated properly, your bowels constrict and you slow down peristalsis. That's the wave-like rhythmic movement that forces food by electrical and mechanical stimulation through the intestine. And a laxative becomes then the most common cause of constipation, because it takes over what should be a natural body effort, and now the body loses the memory of how to move that through. And colonics, or not enemas, can in effect do the same thing. So if there's a specific reason you're getting an enema, if you've had acute constipation, and if olive oil does not work, and if psyllium with vitamin C does not work, if apple skins twice a day, blended in a blender, does not work, then an enema may be useful. Otherwise, the enema is not as useful, because an enema is not a colonic. An enema is not going clear up into the intestine. So that would be my answer. All right, we'll wait till tomorrow to take another one, because I want to give you some insights. And again, this is merely to show you that whoever you vote for is your business, not mine. But why are you voting for someone? What is it that you know or don't know about a person? And the worst place to learn about a person is on the campaign trail, because people will tell you whatever is viewed in that moment, and they have all kinds of people, dozens and dozens of people, who have their finger in the wind deciding what is important that people want to hear about, and then you go in and suddenly become an advocate for it, even if you've been just opposite that your whole life. And that's virtually all the people who are running for office, except Bernie Sanders, and except the woman from Hawaii, Gillard, what's her name? In any case, let me give you a little background on Kamala Harris. And then remember, this is who she is. What she pretends to be is different. First of all, she's been playing the black card, announcing her candidacy at Howard College and on Martin Luther King Day, and calling herself the female Obama. First, I think that's very lazy. And secondly, if you heard Don Lemon on CNN just, what, two nights ago, he really went after her. He says, you're not African-American, and it's okay, say what you are, but don't say you're African-American. Your mom is from where? Mother's from India, father's from Jamaica. So a woman argued, well, a lot, and it's true, a lot of the people in Jamaica started off in Africa and were brought there. And he said, that still doesn't make you an African-American. So anyhow, that's an argument that you will hear more about. And again, it's irrelevant to me. She's a human being, all right? And she should not, no one should be elected based upon identity politics. You've already done that, and you see the mess that that happened. Well, we want people who are qualified to be president for all people and to be so on an ethical basis. But look at her ethics as Attorney General of California. She was regressive, not progressive. There's a Jacobin article about her called Two-Faced. Some of her progressive achievements were way overmatched by her conservative regressive ones. She's been a champion of the old tired tough on crime. Remember that, of the Clintons? And for a long time, she urged to move forward with criminal justice reforms, and she said no. And the human rights groups came up against her, and the ACLU came up against her. She didn't care. She ignored the wrongful convictions that she was supposed to overturn, and she refused to investigate the police for misconduct, including tampering with evidence and false testimony. In one case, a police lab technician had 600 cases filed against her. But who came to her defense and refused to withdraw those convictions? Yeah, that's Ms. Harris. Other cases where she refused to side with wrongful convictions, she should have simply said, we made a mistake in this, the state apologizes, let's seek reparations for the time this person was wrongfully imprisoned. No, she wouldn't do it. She was a huge supporter and pushed for family DNA testing, meaning if you were arrested, regardless whether you were charged or not released, you were forced to give your DNA. And that is unfortunate. She was a strong proponent of civil asset forfeiture. And we know now that the government is, and the police have confiscated billions of dollars per year of innocent people's assets, cars, houses, businesses, and cash, emptied out their credit card accounts because they were allowed to. And she was one of the major voices supporting asset forfeiture. And even when no one was ever charged with anything, she opposed an earlier bill to reform asset forfeiture. And she refused to reduce sentencing, including drug possession, for minor low-level felonies. Over two-thirds of Americans oppose mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders and support more probation. She didn't want you to have probation. She put your ass in prison. So just remember the next time she plays her race and identity card, and well, so did Hillary Clinton, and they'll put your ass in prison, and she did, as Attorney General and District Attorney. So exactly how now is she supposed to be challenging Joe Biden? He's the easiest guy in the world. He's such an idiot. But, I mean, he is. He's really, God, this guy's a human gaff machine. So, yeah, he didn't support busing. Yeah, and most people then don't and didn't and now don't either. But that's not the issue. The issue is she was gaining some points by positioning him as being the racist old man. Well, let's look at your record. Let's take a look at all the people, including minorities, that you put in prison for possession of marijuana who rotted there for years. And what happened to their families? She also was a big supporter of the private industrial prison complex. And she's been overly supportive and trusting of law enforcement. And she believes, you know, that the police are right. Okay, that's her belief. She refused to support a bill to standardize body cameras on police. She opposed a bill requiring her own office to investigate shootings involving officers. Her position on law enforcement have frequently been criticized by the ACLU. And she was news savvy. And interesting because the African-American Californians say she has a record of a rampant anti-blackness. She's a failure to prosecute Steve Munchens, that's Trump's Treasury Secretary, in 2013 on widespread foreclosure violations. And she supported legislation that habitually truant elements, school kids, could be prosecuted. And so she wants the parents prosecuted, too. So let's just say that you have a kid that's going out to school, you think, but doesn't go to school. You've done all you can as a parent, but maybe then the friends, the peers, say, let's go do something else. So the kid gets picked up, and now she wanted the kid put in jail, but she also wanted the parents charged as well. And these are almost all low-income families. So where's your real support for low-income or minorities? Just like the Clintons and Obama, it doesn't exist. Good to try to play that hand now, but for anyone, which will probably be very few if no one, will look back at your actual record throughout your life. She appealed against a federal judge ruling the death penalty was unconstitutional. At the time, there were 740 men and women on death row. So they wanted the death penalty eliminated in California, and she knew. Like Schwarzenegger did one of the most reprehensibly vile things that he should never be forgiven for. There was a former gang member, and he was a criminal, and he was serving life imprisonment. He was on death row, but he had turned his life around, and he was writing books for kids not to get into gangs and not to do the wrong things with their lives. And he was a major voice. And Schwarzenegger refused to allow him to stay life imprisonment, made sure he died. And I ask, what good does it do to kill a person who has turned their life around and has best-selling books informing children there's a better way to grow up than through crime? Think of how many more people he could have motivated. And yet Schwarzenegger, who has no redeeming value on these issues, was playing the political conservative card that they never saw a person who shouldn't die who should die, right? Kill them all. Let God sort it out. Isn't that the way most conservatives think? God, what repressive people. And she also opposed marijuana reform for recreational use. Yes, she wanted your ass in jail for a long time, and you know what happens in jail for even a short time. So just remember the next time you hear her say anything about her caring for people, then where in the hell was she her entire career when she was prosecuting people, the poor, people of color, people with economic disadvantage? No. This is the part that nobody wants to talk about, but I'm going to. For each of these candidates, I have a background on every one of them. And so look at a few other things. She was one of the fiercest. Let me read an article. This is an article verbatim by Laura Bizzalone, law professor and former director of the Loyola Law School Project for Innocent in Los Angeles, published in the New York Times, and something worth reading here. Quote, with the growing recognition that prosecutors hold the keys to a fairer criminal justice system, the term progressive prosecutor has almost become trendy. This is how Senator Kamala Harris of California, a likely presidential candidate and a former prosecutor, describes herself. But she's not. After time, when progressives urged her to embrace criminal justice reforms as a district attorney and then the state's attorney general, Ms. Harris opposed them or stayed silent. Most troubling, Ms. Harris fought tooth and nail to uphold wrongful convictions that had been secured through official misconduct that included evidence tampering, false testimony, and suppression of crucial information by prosecutors. Consider a record as San Francisco District Attorney from 2004 to 2011. Ms. Harris was criticized in 2010 for withholding information about a police laboratory technician who had been accused of intentionally sabotaging her work and stealing drugs from the lab. After a memo surfaced showing that Ms. Harris' deputies knew about the technician's wrongdoing and recent conviction, but failed to alert defense attorneys, a judge condemned Mrs. Harris' indifference to the systemic violation of the defendant's constitutional rights. Ms. Harris contested the ruling by arguing that the judge, whose husband was a defense attorney and had spoken publicly about the importance of disclosing evidence, had a conflict of interest. Ms. Harris lost. More than 600 cases handled by the corrupt technician were dismissed. Ms. Harris also championed state legislation under which parents whose children were found to be habitually truant in elementary school could be prosecuted, despite concerns that it would disproportionately affect low-income people of color. Ms. Harris was similarly regressive as the state's attorney general. When a federal judge in Orange County ruled that the death penalty was unconstitutional in 2014, Ms. Harris appealed. In 2014, she declined to take a position on Proposition 47, a ballot initiative approved by voters that reduced certain low-level felonies to misdemeanors. She laughed that year when a reporter asked if she would support the legalization of marijuana for recreational use. In 2015, she opposed a bill requiring her office to investigate shootings involving police officers, and she refused to support statewide standards regulating the use of body-worn cameras by police officers. For this, she incurred criticism from an array of left-leaning reformers, including Democratic state senators, the ACLU, and San Francisco's elected public defender. The activist Felicia Jones, who had supported Ms. Harris for years, asked, quote, "How many more people need to die before she steps in?" Worst of all, though, is Mrs. Harris' record in wrongful conviction cases. Consider George Gage, an electrician with no criminal record who was charged in 1999 with sexually abusing his stepdaughter, who reported the allegation years later. The case largely hinged on the stepdaughter's testimony, and Mr. Gage was convicted. Afterwards, the judge discovered that the prosecutor had unlawfully held back potentially exculpatory evidence, including medical reports indicating that the stepdaughter had been repeatedly untruthful with law enforcement. Her mother even described her as, quote, "a pathological liar who lives her lies." In 2015, when the case reached the U.S. the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, Ms. Harris' prosecutors defended the conviction. They pointed out that Mr. Gage, while forced to act as his own lawyer, meaning he didn't have a lawyer, had not properly raised the legal issue in the lower court as the law required. The appellate judges acknowledged this impediment and sent the case to mediation, a clear signal for Ms. Harris to dismiss the case. When she refused to budge, the court upheld the conviction on that technicality. Mr. Gage is still in prison, serving a 70-year sentence. Think about that for a moment. Doesn't it remind you of the rapist that Hillary Clinton got off for raping that young, what was she, 12 or 14 years old? And when she's interviewed, she laughs about it, how she, you know, she attacked and humiliated the girl, and she knew the guy was guilty. She acknowledges this, yet not a word, like it didn't matter. And by the way, that case is not an outlier. Mrs. Harris also fought to keep Daniel Larson in prison on a 28-year-to-life sentence for possessing of a concealed weapon, even though his trial lawyer was incompetent and there was compelling evidence of his innocence. Relying upon technicality again, Ms. Harris argued that Mr. Lawson failed to raise his legal arguments in a timely fashion. She also defended Johnny Vacca's conviction for murder, even though judges found a prosecutor presented false testimony at the trial. She relented only after a video of the oral argument received national attention and embarrassed her office. And then there's the case of Kevin Cooper, the death row inmate whose trial was infected by racism and corruption. He sought advanced DNA testing to prove his innocence, but Kamala Harris opposed it. And it was only after the New York Times expose of the case went viral she reversed her position. All this is a shame because the state's top prosecutor has the power and the imperative to seek justice. In cases of tainted convictions, that means conceding error and overturning them. Rather than fulfilling that obligation, Ms. Harris turned legal technicalities into weapons so she could cement injustices. So, and there's more, but that's just to give you an idea of the other side of who she is that we will not see in the debates. And I think that's important that we know the full background on a person, not just how well they're arguing based upon how well they've been coached, based upon trying to get a clean hit in on one of her opponents. That's not how we should be electing people to the most powerful office in the world. We should look at what they've done when they've been in positions of power earlier in their life. So now you have that story. What you do with it is up to you. And I'm looking at the time, and that went over what I had wanted to. Because tomorrow I've got a really dynamite show lined up. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go through a few of the things that I'm concerned with that are happening, just to bring you up to date. All right? And this is now, we're presenting and posting it today on PRN.fm, the most comprehensive scientific evidence in one place ever accumulated on the dangers of 5G frequency. And it's there as a public service. And so here are some of the things we now have that you should be giving to your local and state representatives so they can challenge it at the level. There's a lot of studies on the biological effects of 5G frequency in the low 0.6 hertz to 3.7 gigahertz. For example, electromagnetic biology and medicine, the most critical regions of a child's head absorb 2 to 10 times more electromagnetic frequency than adults, and current exposure limits assume the anatomy of U.S. military recruits. Accountable, independent groups should revise U.S. exposure limits using the actual anatomy. So if you're saying, well, our research was on soldiers, but what about all the children? They're more susceptible. They haven't done it. So you can't say that it's safe for all people. It's not. The physics and medicine and biology, the external shape of the head and the distribution of different tissues within the head plays a significant role in the radio frequency, electromagnetic frequency energy absorption. And based upon examining the anatomical models exposed to radiation at 900, 1800, and 2450 megahertz, so just your head size will determine how much you absorb versus how much you don't. And then from the pathophysiology, scientific reviews after 1986 that were used as a basis of radiation exposure standards excluded scientists with expertise in the health effects from non-thermal doses of cell phone signaling. So the experts who could tell you the dangers of cell phones were not used, none of their research, none of their testimony. And then you have the National Toxicology Program in the United States, and unequivocal evidence of heart cancer from GSM modulating cell phone and RFR at 900 megahertz in male rats after 2 years exposure, and equivocal associations also found between RFR exposure and malignant and non-malignant tumors of the brain, adrenal glands, prostate glands, pituitary glands, and pancreas. And also, the National Toxicological Program in the United States, the equivocal evidence found that after 2 years of exposure to the modulating, there was significant association with lymphoma and liver cancer. And then from the Peer Review Journal PLOS One, the electromagnetic frequencies induced oxidative stress in human sperm, damaging DNA, and these effects correlate to poor fertility and increased miscarriage in childhood cancers and morbidity in the offspring. And then in cell biochemistry and biophysics, low-intensity microwave radiation for 5 days, 2 hours a day, correlates with learning and memory disturbances by altering the brain chemistry. Now, there are hundreds of articles that we brought together and hundreds of scientific citations. It goes on for pages and pages and pages. So that when someone says with such confidence in the mainstream media, who's always going to be a communications industry hack, that it's safe and effective and it's great, we have the evidence that it's not good, that we can prove now that it shouldn't be introduced. So, again, I can only provide you with the research, the scholarship. At some point, you have to feel that your life, your health, your communities is worth sharing this with other people, letting your legislators, including Senator Chuck Schumer, know that we want public hearings, and not public hearings that they select the pro-industry group, and that's what they always do, but where we can select the scientists who have no conflict of interest, but who have the scientific expertise to show you the dangers of 5G. And you can find this list today. I'm writing another major article on this, which will appear in the next week. Thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful day, and yeah, I'll be back here tomorrow.
Yes! Yes!